Okay, everyone, so welcome back again here, and we can continue on the idea of right view. And I'm going to look at some of the more kind of immediate and simple but very practical aspects of right view. Before, we had a look at the idea that right view is an understanding of the Four Noble Truths. But the next paragraph here is more about kind of the ordinary outlook that everyone should have, which is considered right view in Buddhism. Yeah, so it's kind of very simple things, but things that are very fundamental to the living of the spiritual life, and for that reason quite interesting in my opinion here. So I will just comment on these things a little bit. I'm not going to go into great depth, but this sort of thing, we could talk a lot about this, because there is a lot about these aspects in the suttas, but just to give you a kind of a brief idea of what this is all about. So this is a small extract from a sutta called the Brahmins of Sala, and it is just the very little paragraph which talks about right view itself, and this is what it has to say. So one has a right view, undistorted vision, thus there is what is given and what is offered and what is sacrificed. There is fruit and result of good and bad actions. There is this world and the other world. There is a mother and father. There are beings who are reborn spontaneously. There are good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins in the world who have themselves realized by insight and declare this world and the other world. So this is the standard description in the suttas for right view. And you can see there straight away that one of the qualifications of right view is undistorted vision. Yeah, and this kind of gives you the idea that right view just means to align your way of looking at the world with the way the world actually is from the Buddha's perspective. That's what it really means. So we try to align our understanding with reality. And of course that is almost like the very definition of not being deluded. If you see things according to reality, you're not deluded. So what is this? And some of the very basic things here. Yeah, it starts off by saying there is what is given, what is offered, what is sacrificed. And the point of that is simply to say that generosity, is a very important thing in the spiritual life. If you want to make spiritual progress, generosity is a very important part of that. And you see this in the suttas in many places, where the Buddha starts off, he gives the graduated discourse, and very often it starts off with generosity. And then it goes on to sila, then it goes on to renunciation, then it goes on to the Four Noble Truths afterwards. It's a graduated discourse, but it often starts off with generosity. But not as it just start off with generosity, but generosity is then something you develop as you continue practicing this path until you get into a state of samadhi. And when you get into a state of samadhi, at that point, it's almost like you perfect generosity. Generosity is a state of mind. Yeah, it is how we are open to support others and help others and to give our assistance or whatever. And because it is ultimately a state of mind, that state of mind is fully developed when you get to the dana states, the deep states of samadhi. And they say that as a stream enterer, you are fully generous. Yeah, you are always willing to help, always willing to give, always willing to hand out. And this is one of the qualities that you can decide whether somebody, not trying to really decide, but one of the qualities that you should expect in a stream mentor is that they are very open with their time, with helping out, always doing things for others. Just because someone is very helpful doesn't mean they're stream mentor, but if they're not, then you can, then probably they're not the stream mentor. That's really all you can say, I suppose. So generosity is very fundamental to the Buddhist teachings. And so the question then often arises, how should one be generous? What is the right attitude? How to do this? And there's a fairly large number of suttas about this. The Buddha talks about this in various ways. And I will quote some of the standard suttas that I like to talk about in this connection. And one of the great suttas that always had an impact on me was when the Buddha was talking to King Pasenadi of Kosala. And the king asks the Buddha, where should a gift be given? Yeah, I haven't included these sutras here because I thought I would just talk about it fairly briefly. Where should a gift be given? And sometimes I have noticed that in Buddhist circles, we are very good at supporting Buddhist causes, but sometimes we neglect kind of the broader idea of being generous and kind, kind of to kind of in a broader sense. And so for that reason, the Buddha's answer to this question is very interesting. Where should one be generous? And the Buddha replies, very interesting, that you should be generous wherever you feel confidence, wherever you feel kind of inspired to be generous. That is where you should give. Yeah, so whenever you feel the urge to give coming up, you feel a sense of compassion, you feel that you want to support something, that is the right time to give. It doesn't matter so much where it is, yeah, that is not kind of the main issue. The main issue is where you feel inspired, where you feel it is the right time to do things. And it's a very interesting reply. Why does the Buddha reply like that? The next question the king asks is, well, where is the most great merit? And of course, the place where there's most merit is the place where you find people who have understood the truth and these kind of things, which is what you might expect, yeah? So if you give to people who are enlightened, then of course, that is going to be powerful. If you give to a sangha of monastics, hopefully there are some enlightened ones. Well, in the larger sangha, there will always be some enlightened ones. So if you give with a large view like that, then of course, that will often have a lot of good impact later on. But this does not mean that this is the only place we should give. You should give wherever you feel inspired, wherever you feel like confident about what is going on. And I think the reason for that is because when you give where you feel inspired, it often has a very powerful effect on you because you remember that. You can draw on it later on. You come to your meditation practice, you sit down and you can feel the reverberations of that act of giving afterwards. You are mindful, you are joyous with that kind of gift. And that mindfulness and that joy that you have when you give, it comes back to you later on. This is kind of just the idea of karma, because it makes a large imprint on your mind. And in this way, you actually learn to give. Yeah, you learn the power of giving. So instead of giving in a calculating way, yeah, you kind of have a table of the amount of merit. Yeah, if I give like this, there's so much merit, if I give like that, so much merit. Yeah. This is the wrong way. If you're too calculating, it destroys the joy. It destroys the spontaneity of giving. Yeah? That is not the right way of doing things. Yeah, I wonder, where are the arahants living these days? Yeah, maybe I should go there and give. It kind of destroys the joy of giving. So this is the point. So don't, you know, so in this way, you also expand out your mind. You understand that giving is always good. It's always a positive thing here. So when you feel that inspiration, you learn how to give in a good way. It encourages you to do more in the future. Of course, it's wonderful to support Buddhist causes. It's great. But try also to go slightly beyond that if you possibly can. This is the right way of thinking about things. And eventually, your heart opens up, yeah, and you want to give everywhere. And we have to say, stop, okay, relax. You need to live yourself as well. Yeah, don't give everything away. Keep a little bit for yourself. Otherwise, there's a problem. And it's very interesting. There are some examples of that in the suttas. There's a rule for monastics. Yeah, the rule is that if someone is overly generous, you are not supposed to, supposed to kind of approach them for, you know, for even if they want to give to you, you should be a bit reluctant to accept. Yeah, there's a rule that says unless they have specifically invited you, you should not actually accept anything from that family because they're too generous. Yeah, the children aren't eating properly anymore. Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah, and of course then you have an obligation as a monk. Yeah, to hold back a little bit. So it's amazing how sometimes people really get extraordinarily generous to the point of their own detriment. So this is the right way of giving. Yeah? And again, the idea of giving is that when you give, you try to give in such a way that it leaves a large impact on your mind. Yeah, so you try to be mindful about it. You try to understand that what you're doing is that you are, if you give to a Buddhist cause, you're supporting this enormous thing we call Buddhism in the world, this force for good, usually for good anyway, not sometimes you wonder, but usually it's a force for good. Yeah, the teachings are out there helping people to improve, helping people to become overcome their suffering in the world. You know, when you support like the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, Ajahn Brahm gives a talk, it reaches 4 million people or something like that. Yeah, some of his talks that are so popular, you are what you are supporting is this massive movement, this large thing. And by supporting that, you also have a share in the improvement in people's lives that come as a consequence of practicing these teachings. Isn't that wonderful? Yeah. When you think like that, it inspires you, it lifts you up, and it becomes a force in your practice when you think about these things in the right way. So that is how to think about generosity, to do it in a kind of in this sort of way. And try also to, when you are generous, try to do it. Yeah, the Buddha says that best way to be generous is just to give, because you know giving is good and because you feel good about it afterwards. Yeah, that's kind of the main reasons for giving. You feel good about it. It purifies you. It brightens up your mind. It helps you in your meditation practice. It supports you in the practice of the path. If you give like that, it's very powerful. If you give thinking about, you know, next week I might win the lotto if I give today, then not so good. Yeah, it's kind of, it detracts a little bit from the giving because it's too self-centered, too greedy, instead of having the lofty kind of goals or whatever. So that's just very briefly about generosity and the importance of that in Buddhism, to the point where it is part of right view. Then the Buddha says there is fruit and result of good and bad actions. And again, this is a very important aspect of the Buddhist teachings, and it is something that I would encourage you to investigate in your own life. I've been talking about this briefly already, but it's very important to understand this idea of kamma in Buddhism. Kamma, kamma vipaka. Kamma is the action. Kamma vipaka is the result of action. Yeah, in the way that the word kamma or karma is used these days in contemporary society, it is often used as the result of action. Yeah, oh, that's my bad kamma, I'm suffering. But actually, it doesn't mean that. Kamma is the cause. Vipaka is the result, is what you feel as a consequence of that. How can we approach this? Very often people think of kamma, yeah, I do good in this life, it has some good effect in the future life. Yeah. And yes, that may very well be so, but it's very difficult to kind of get that and to see that it is true. It is not easy, unless you can remember your past lives or something like that. So it's much more important, I think, to look at the kamma. The Buddha talks about three types of kamma. There's the kamma which ripens in this life, the kamma which ripens in your next life, and the kamma which ripens in future lives beyond that. The kamma that we can see is the kamma that ripens right here in this life. Dit eva dhamma kamma, or something like that. Yeah, something like that. And the way that you see that, the way you can actually see the kamma ripening right here, right now, and I mentioned this before, is to feel the consequences of your actions. Yeah, if you do an act of kindness, really coming from your heart, really wanting to be kind to somebody, saying something nice, supporting someone, you feel good afterwards, yeah. You feel happy about that. There's something inside of you which gets lifted up. Your mind gets brighter. You feel good about doing something positive. And afterwards, you have a kind of quiet satisfaction about yourself. You know that you are living well. And that is good. It is good to know that you are living well. There's nothing selfish about that. It's not about kind of beating yourself on the chest and thinking that you are great, a wonderful person. It's not about ego. It's just about the simple knowledge that you know that you are living your life in a good way. That is a positive thing, and it will always enhance your meditation practice. So feel that connection. Sometimes all you have to do is to have a kind thought. And this is why we do metta meditation, to learn how to think with kindness with other people. And already that will kind of lift you up and make you brighter, brighten up your mind, feel lighter as a person, feel more kind of joyful and more kind of, you know, all of these things will come as a consequence. And then there is the opposite effect. And if you look at your mind very carefully, if you do something which is not nice, even if you think a bad thought, it often drains your energy. You feel a bit more dark inside. You feel a bit kind of pressed down, oppressed by this kind of heavy emotion or whatever. Yeah? See that connection. What you are seeing there is really what I would call kamma in action, right here in the present moment. And if you then extrapolate and you as think of that, you know, if you do good actions again and again and again, always lifting yourself up, always brightening up the mind, the accumulative effect of that is actually very, this is where you're building up karma in a cumulative way. More and more and more, and you're actually on this trajectory moving upwards in your life, your mind becoming a more and more wholesome place. On the other hand, if you accumulate many bad actions, it has exactly the opposite effect. You're dragging yourself down into a darker and more miserable place in your life. And for most people, we do a mixture of both. So we're kind of going a bit kind of wave, kind of, you know, up and down. And then the sum total of what we do is what is going to decide roughly where we're going. So the more we can do of the good, the more we can avoid the bad things, the more powerful it's going to be for us in our life. And so you can see here what we are doing, basically. And once you start to see this in your own life, it becomes a very powerful motivation for living well. It makes you so careful. You know that every moment matters. Every action, every word, every thought is actually important. Yeah. Every time you do something wrong, you're letting yourself down. You're moving away from the Noble Eightfold Path. You are reducing your own happiness and also reducing the happiness of the world around you. Every moment matters. Life is so short. If you don't take every opportunity, before you know it, it's going to be too late. Yeah, now is the opportunity. Don't miss out. This is the chance to do what is right. You get this sense of urgency, the sense of, you know, and then you persevere with that urgency, persevere and commit to these very basic things that are still so hard to do on a consistent basis. To be able to do it, you have to understand the importance of this. See, get motivated by understanding this law of karma directly, immediately, right here, right now, in your present life. And then, of course, if you do that and you kind of are on this upward trajectory, then when you die, guess what happens? You have already lifted yourself up. That's where you are. That's where you continue. And that's what we mean by karma in the future life. Yeah? You have already lifted yourself up. You are at a higher state of consciousness, more happy than you were before. So you continue there. And that is how you then get reborn and you reap the benefits of of the actions that you do in this life. You reap the benefit in the future life. When you look at it like that, it's actually very easy to understand how the idea of karma works. There's nothing really magical about it, nothing weird. Yeah, it's it's a very natural sequence. That is how I would recommend you to think about karma, because it is it's easy to understand. And also a very powerful motivating force. So, there you are. There are fruit and results of good and bad actions. There is this world and the other world. And of course, this is very closely related to the previous idea. And again, it shows you that the Buddha, when he talks about the suttas, or he talks about the reality, it is about, you know, different kind of world. You go from this world and you go to the other world. Yeah, you move on into the future life. This is a standard way of talking about future lives, rebirth, and all of these kind of things. And also an idea that, you know, sometimes you can get reborn in different places. Yeah, so there is this world, there is the other world. There is rebirth. It's a fundamental aspect of the Buddha's teachings, the idea of rebirth. Without the idea of rebirth, basically, Dhamma falls apart. The teaching of the Buddha falls apart. That is how fundamental it is. So please don't underestimate this very important teaching in Buddhism. It's quite interesting. Sometimes when you read some of the, you know, articles on science and this sort of thing, and because very often the reason why people don't believe in rebirth is that they argue it is not scientific and all of this. Remember that science is, the way science works, is that it often gets kind of stuck in certain ideas. And then you have like a revolution and new ideas emerge. Yeah? And one of the things that I have been noticing over the last few years is that science has been shifting quite a lot. The philosophers and certain scientists, especially in the areas of physics and neuroscience, where they have, basically, there was a very famous article, not famous, that's kind of exaggerating, there was an article in Nature. Nature is the premier scientific journal in the world, number one. And there was an article in there, one of the main physicists at one of the large universities in the US says that we need to come to grips with the fact that physics is basically mental by nature. Yeah, why? Because all the quantum physics, all that, well, it's actually, it works according to the observer. It only, you only get a result in quantum physics when you observe the experiment. The observer decides the outcome. And this is now slowly becoming more and more mainstream. Yeah, you can see these things like the Scientific American, a very conservative American paper that kind of publishes about scientific results. Now they have people writing regularly about the importance of mind. Yeah, and it's kind of this only happened over the last few months. Things are really changing very rapidly in science. So we have to understand the limits of science, because science goes according to this paradigm, and suddenly it shifts, and suddenly it brings mind back into nature again. Over the last few decades, we have excluded mind from nature in Western science. It's really weird. How can you exclude mind from nature? And now finally, kind of the pendulum is swinging back again. So don't be too concerned always about scientific science. Sometimes science is really spot on, but sometimes they have blind spots because they are stuck in a certain way of seeing the world. What they are saying may be true, but it may have certain limitations on it, and that is what you have to remember. So I have found it very fascinating. There's more and more lead researchers around the world who are taking mind into consideration, and I think, I don't know, it looks to me like it's not going to be long before we have a massive shift in scientific outlook in mainstream science. Anyway, this is just to kind of be careful with these ideas, not to dismiss them too quickly. That's what I'm saying, I suppose. So the idea of rebirth being very important in Buddhism, including the idea of different types of rebirth. Then we have the next one there is mother and father. Yeah, very interesting little thing that this should be part of right view. There is mother and father. And the reason that is there is because I think it's fairly obvious, that we are talking here about rebirth and karma largely, is because our parents are a very powerful field of karma. How we deal with our parents is actually very, very important for how whether we have spiritual progress or not, basically. That's what it means. And you will know from the sutta that if you treat your parents really badly, yeah, if you kill your parents, kind of the ultimately bad thing you can do towards your parents, then it will have very, very severe karmic results if you do that. But the counterpoint to that, the opposite of that, is if you treat your parent well, it has very powerful positive results. Yeah, it actually has a very powerful, it's a very powerful support in your practice. So for those of you who still have parents who are alive, it's a wonderful opportunity to take that chance to do what you can to do the right thing by your parents. I know sometimes people have very difficult relationships with their parents. Yeah, a minority of people have that, and it's important to kind of to listen to their experience as well. And of course, if you have a very difficult relationship, then it is not really expected that you live up to the highest standards here. Instead, what you try to do is you try to deal with your situation to the best of your ability, perhaps by forgiving a little bit and these sort of things. You're not supposed to kind of just go back and be very friendly with your parents just out of the blue. But for those of you who have a decent relationship with your parents, see if you can do something extra, yeah, something additional to support them, to be kind to them. How do we do that without making it into a burden? Because sometimes people think, kind of, parents, oh, such a burden, you have to look after them and all of these kind of things. But how can we do this without making it into something difficult? And the way to do this is just often to remember what our parents have done for us. Yeah, I think back, one of the things that the Buddha says about parents, they are the Pubbacharya. Pubbacharya means the first teachers, yeah, the early teachers. They are, our parents have taught us all the basic things that we need in life, have been taught by our parents. Yeah, how to eat, how to dress, how to go to the toilet, how to wash. Everything comes from our parents. Yeah, how to be able to read the time and all these kind of things. Our parents have been so fundamental. Without our parents, obviously we wouldn't be here. That's very, very obvious. But in a broader sense too, we wouldn't really be here. We wouldn't be able to function in society without our parents. And once you realize that, you start to get a sense of gratitude for what they have done for you. Another thing the Buddha says about our parents, he compares our parents to Brahma. Yeah, and it's, you know, what is it about Brahma? And of course, Brahma, or the Brahma Loka, is the Loka of the four Brahma Viharas, Metta, Karuna, loving kindness, compassion, all of these things. So what the Buddha is saying is that parents have almost endless metta or kindness towards their children, always willing to forgive, always willing to let go of whatever stupid things that we do when we are young and teenagers and rebellious and all of these kinds of things. That is true. You know, the last person to give up on you is usually your mother. You go to prison, you do all kind of crazy stuff, and your mother very often is still there to support you afterwards. Why? Because your mother is always able to see something good in you. She always remembers you when you were a child. She sees the good qualities in you. And for that reason, you can actually, she can always be positive towards you and forgives you. And it's actually one of those beautiful little lines in the Metta Sutta where you should, you know, act as a mother acts towards her only child. Yeah, how does a mother act towards her only child? Well, she only always has metta, always forgives. So if we think of other people a little bit as if we are the mother to the only child, then you can forgive everyone. And you can have compassion, and you can have loving kindness for almost anyone in the world. So this is the beauty of parents, that they kind of, they have endless forbearance, endless ability to forgive and let go of the past. What a wonderful thing that is. So remember that. And when you remember these things, you start to increase your ability to support your parents in a good way. At the same time, it is also important to remember that your parents are just ordinary people in many ways. They are no different from everyone else. They have their history, they have their habits, they have their past lives. And because of that, you should never expect your parents to be perfect. It is marvelous enough to have good parents who have supported you. Yeah, that is actually good enough. So you shouldn't expect perfect relationships. So because of that, you can forgive the little foibles, the little kind of sillinesses and whatever. And by doing all of this, then you are able to give that little extra to your parents. And this is a kind of, contemplation that I have been doing over a long time, especially after becoming a monk. And I was no different from anyone else. When I was kind of young, I was rebellious and kind of did all kind of bad things, to my parents. But I've realized that actually it was my own stupidity. Yes, we are rebellious when we are young. And I think it's important to be a bit rebellious. I think we should expect young people to be like that. We shouldn't expect them just to follow along. Usually that's a sign of someone who might get depressed later on. If you kind of just follow along with everything, it's good to exert your personality a little bit and be a bit different. You should allow young people to be like that. But then the pendulum swings back, and then you start to understand, actually, there is something beautiful going on here. And then you are able to support your parents instead later on. When that happens, it becomes very powerful. So try to think a bit like that, and then you have more patience, and then you have more ability to do what is right. Okay. There are beings who are reborn spontaneously. This, I think, is just about, again, expanding the idea of rebirth. Rebirth doesn't just happen among humans, but the scope for how karma takes effect, it is actually vastly expanded once you take into account the idea of spontaneously arisen beings. You're kind of enlarging things out. You don't just have the human realm, but you have all these other realms as well. It just kind of expands out the scope of karma. I think that's kind of roughly the idea of that. And then the last one is that there are good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins in the world who have themselves realized by insight and declare this world and the other world. And in some ways, this is the most fundamental of all the right views, because if you don't think that there are anyone in this world who has seen more than you have, well, then you have no basis for having faith or confidence in the Buddha. You have no basis for going to the suttas and being inspired. Yeah? Then you have no basis for anything really, except for kind of believing in materialism and believing in kind of the, you know, the latest model car or whatever it is. That's really all there is left after that. So this is very fundamental, the idea that there are people in the world who have some spiritual insight, some understanding. And it kind of makes sense, you know, in most areas of life we accept that there are people with expertise. Yeah, you go to medical school to learn about medicine, you go to law school to learn about law, because there are experts there who can teach you about these things. In the same way, if somebody has been practicing the ascetic life or the monastic life for a long time, like the Buddha or whoever else, then it's natural to think that these people have some insight, some understanding. You see somebody, you know, like some of these people who have been living in the forest for decades, far away without any conveniences or any modcoms or anything like that, a very simple life. And somehow they have exude some sort of wisdom, some sort of understanding, some sort of equanimity, something powerful about them, despite the fact that they live so far away from society. It gives you a feeling that there's something more in the world. How can people live like that over long periods of time and still have compassion, still have metta, still have all these good qualities? Well, the only thing that they can really have access to is something in meditation practice, yeah? So it gives you this sense that there's something going on there. So this is a very important part of the Buddhist path. It's really at the foundation of everything else, because this is where you get the Kalyanamitta from, the good friendship, yeah? The Buddha is the Kalyanamitta number one. Without that, the whole spiritual path really stops from the very root, and you don't get anywhere. So there you are. That is the just a little bit about the ordinary right view. And remember what I was saying before, that such, even these simple ordinary right views, it is not either yes or no. Yes, I have right view. No, I haven't got right view. Yeah, the idea is that these views themselves are developed. Yeah, you start off maybe consenting to this at the basic level, and then as you learn more about the Buddhist path, and as you do your own practice and your meditation and all that, these views get stronger, they get clarified, they get more straightened up, more and more in line with how the Buddha saw these things. So right view is not a matter of just yes and no. It's a matter of development, a matter of kind of improving it all the time, reading the suttas, contemplating this, reflecting on this. What does it mean to be generous? Yeah. What are the consequences of rebirth? How do my actions now affect the state how I feel about myself? All of these things are worthy of reflection. The more introspection you have about this, the more clear it becomes to you, the more powerful it becomes as a driving force on the Noble Eightfold Path. Again, this is why right view is there at the very beginning here, as a starting point, which kind of makes the whole thing kind of work and move forward. Now I would like to have a look at one last sutta, which concerns, actually all the suttas concern right view in some way, but this is kind of more directly involved with right view. This is some of the fairly well-known suttas in the group of suttas in the Sanyutta Nikaya. And these are kind of big picture samsara. What samsara means in the big picture. What does it mean that there is rebirth? What does it mean that there are results of karma? What does this mean in the big scale of things? Yeah, and this is what this sutta is about. And I like to read it out. It's quite stark and quite kind of, this is kind of a bit too much. But precisely because it is stark, it is a very, in many ways, a very Buddhist outlook on the nature of reality. So let's just have a brief look at this. It's called Tears. Yeah, that kind of sets the scene for what this sutta is about. At Savati, because this samsara is without discoverable beginning. The first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. What do you think, monks? Which is more, the stream of tears that you have shed as you roamed and wandered on through this long course, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable. This, or the water in the four great oceans. And of course, you know the answer already to that question, so I may not have to read the rest, but let us discuss this first paragraph, first of all, because it's a very, quite a dense paragraph, and there's a lot of interesting points here. I'm not going to go into them in great detail, but for those of you who are not so used to the suttas, just to have a look at what is going on here. So you have, first of all, the Buddha starts off, because this samsara, the word samsara means like the going on, the moving on, the eternal kind of cycle of things, eternal moving on from life to life, from death to birth, from birth to death, etc. Yeah, and this eternal moving on, this eternal wandering on is without discoverable beginning. Yeah. Now, what exactly is the implication of that? The implication of that is that if you kind of accept the Buddhist idea that the Buddha remembered his past lives, then no matter how far you go into the past, you cannot discover any first point. Yeah, the Buddha is supposed to have remembered eons back. Yeah, world contractions and world expansions, going back and back and back for eons. And he says, no matter how far back you go, you cannot discover a first point. There's always another cause before the previous cause, yeah, going back and back and back. And what is interesting about this is that the Buddha does not say that there is no first point. He says that there is no discoverable first point. And this is a subtle difference that shows you something about how the Buddha operates and how he works. If you say that there is no first point, you're making a philosophical claim about something that you can never actually know, because you cannot go back into infinity, yeah? All you can do is go back so far, unless you actually do find the first point, of course, in which case you would have proven it, but assuming that the, you know, all he can really say here, if there isn't any first point, is that I cannot discover a first point. No matter how far back I go, there is no discovery of a first point. So the point of this is that the Buddha is pragmatic. He is looking at the evidence. I can't discover any first point, so because I can't discover it, that is what I say. I don't say that there is no first point. So the Buddha is always kind of talking about the evidence that he has seen. He doesn't make any, what is called, like a metaphysical or philosophical claim about the universe. Buddhism is not about philosophy, it is about dealing with what is actual, what you can discover, what is there. And in that sense, it has a lot in common with a scientific inquiry. Yeah, it's about inquiring and seeing what is there, not about creating abstract philosophy. And this again is something, one of those little, tiny little points, yeah, that to me make the Buddhist teaching so so acceptable and so beautiful and so kind of sensible in many ways, and how it is very different from sometimes, for example, later Buddhist teachings. In later Buddhist teachings, they start to make more metaphysical and philosophical claims. And one of the claims they make in later Buddhist teaching is that there is no beginning here. Yeah, but that's where they have, in my opinion, they have lost the plot a little bit. They haven't really understood, as far as I can see, why the Buddha phrased it in this particular way here. There is no discoverable beginning. A first point is not discerned. You can't find the first point of beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving here. And this is, again, another beautiful little thing here. There's many beautiful things going on here. The idea of beings roaming and wandering. Yeah, the English word roam, the idea of roaming is that you have no direction. You're not going anywhere. There is no goal. There is no purpose. You're kind of aimlessly wandering around. Yeah, going this way, going that way, going up, going down, going from one birth to another one. There's no purpose. That's what roaming is about. It's kind of random walking about without any kind of goal. And this is kind of the, you know, the slightly worrying thing about samsara, is that you're not actually going anywhere. Yeah, you're just back and forth doing the same thing again and again. Yeah, you have been coming, maybe this is the, you know, coming to this retreat centers for how many lifetimes? Yeah, you have been we have been doing things, you know, how many lifetimes, you know, going to school, going to university, getting married, having children, working really hard, getting a pension, and then dying, and then doing it again, and again, and again. And after a while, it becomes pointless. Yeah, it becomes utterly, completely silly. After doing that a million times and never really learning any lessons from it, because you forget about it every time, you're as blind in this life as it was in the last time, then it starts, the whole thing starts to lose kind of its meaning. And the strange thing, though, is that it feels so meaningful to us. Yeah, I just know that from my own life. You know, when you're young, you go to university, yeah, it feels like you're heading towards something, like you're going to have a career, you have some idea what your life is going to be like. It seems so purposeful. It seems that it actually is a purpose. But that's just an illusion. It's an illusion created by the sense of self, created by this the doer inside, because we need, that's what the self, sense of self does. It creates a sense of purpose for us. But when you see things in the big picture, and this is what this really is about, is the bird's eye view, yeah, the overview of what is happening. Suddenly you understand that all you are doing is roaming around without purpose, without any kind of goal, up and down, being born here, now being born there, doing the same thing over and over. And this is why the bird's eye view is so important. The overview is so important. Standing at the top of the mountain instead of standing in the jungle, why that is so important. So you know what's going on. And the whole thing starts to become slightly unbearable when you start to see this. You think, I can't stand this any longer. This is what the Buddha sees on his night of awakening. When he, before his awakening experience, he remembers his past life. That is what enables him to become awakened, because he understands suffering. As I was saying before, the idea of suffering is understood in large part by seeing the process of rebirth itself. The first noble truth and the first direct insight into the nature of reality are very closely related to each other. So this is what is going on here. This is what this is about. Roaming and wandering on is a very apt way of talking about samsaric existence. And hindered by ignorance, yeah, and this is kind of the problem. We are, because of that avidya, because we don't know what is going on, we are fumbling around in the dark. We can't remember that we have done this so many times before. We don't understand how pointless it is. To us, it feels so purposeful. Yeah, it feels like, yes, we're going somewhere, we're doing something. We are completely blind. We don't really know what's happening to us. So we are hindered by our inability to see the world as it actually is. This is why confidence and faith at the beginning is so necessary to get started. And then we are fettered by craving. Craving is what ties us to samsara. It is the rope that binds us to birth and death. Yeah, why? Because craving just keeps on projecting us into the future. It keeps on perpetuating the round of existence from life to life, from eon to eon, going on and on and on. Yeah, this is what the Buddha saw, and this is why he says, wake up, yeah, wake up, I will turn on the light for you. The Buddha says, I am the eye of the world. Why? Because I have seen, and now I tell you what I've seen. So I'm kind of becoming your vision, and I'm kind of handing on the information that I've seen to you to enable you also to make a start on the spiritual path and get out of this mess that we're all in. Hindered by ignorance, fettered by craving, yeah. What do you think, bhikkhus? And then comes kind of the, what this is all pointing to. Yeah. Which is more, the stream of tears that you have shed as you roamed and wandered on through this long course, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, this or the water in the four great oceans? As we understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, the stream of tears that we have shed as we roamed and wandered through this long course, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, this alone is more than the water in the four great oceans. Good, good, monks, it is good that you understand the Dhamma taught by me in such a way. The stream of tears that you have shed as you roamed and wandered through this long course, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, This alone is more than the water in the four great oceans. For a long time, because you have experienced the death of a mother. As you have experienced this, weeping and wailing, because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, the stream of tears that you have shed is more than the water in the four great oceans. For a long time, monks, you have experienced the death of a father, the death of a brother, the death of a sister, the death of a son, the death of a daughter, the loss of relatives, the loss of wealth, the loss through illness. Yeah, and each one is to be expanded as before. As you have experienced this, weeping and wailing, because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, the stream of tears that you have shed is more than the water in the four great oceans. For what reason? Because this samsara is without discoverable beginning. The first point is not discerned, or beings roaming and wandering on, hindered by ignorance, or hindered by delusion, if you like, and fettered by craving. So this kind of draws together all the things that we have been talking about before. It draws together the idea of impermanence, the idea of non-self. Yeah, there is no kind of purpose to this. It is not actually going anywhere. There is no self as part of this equation. The idea of suffering is certainly drawn out of this very starkly and very powerfully. It draws together the idea of rebirth and karma and its results, and everything really comes back in a very powerful way in a sutta like this. So again, remember the purpose of these kind of suttas. It's not to just to consent to it and say, yes, I believe in this, but just to reflect on this. What if this is true? What if there is a rebirth? Is this actually the... what happens if there is rebirth? If there is rebirth, is this the necessary consequence of rebirth? And really, if you think about it, very likely it is a necessary consequence of rebirth, if such a thing actually exists. Yeah, so reflect on this, and reflect on how it actually affects your own life. And it becomes a very powerful thing as a consequence. One of the things that I always found, one of the kind of nice ways of thinking about the idea of rebirth. One of the problems is sometimes that we feel the sense of self often gets in the way. It gets in the way because it feels like we have a sense of direction, a sense of purpose, we know what we're doing. But sometimes we are just, it is just a very powerful delusion, an illusion in our lives. And this became very starkly clear to me when I was talking to this person, and I told this story many times before, but this was this person who had some kind of past life recollection. I'm not going to go into the details of how he had this recollection of a past life, but to him it was a very, very powerful thing. And he was able to check up this recollection with, and actually finding out that there's such a person that he thought himself to be actually existed. Yeah, and he looked it up, and he was, after that, he became absolutely sure that he had been this person in the past life. And one of the interesting things that he had to say about this was not the fact that, yes, there is rebirth, but the consequences of there being rebirth. Because he was, in this life, he was a very successful person. He had kind of built up his own business and made a lot of money through this business and all of that. And he was very proud of this. Yeah, oh, this is my work. I have done this. Yeah, taking it all a little bit too personally, perhaps. Yeah, a little bit too much self, perhaps, involved in that. And then he had this recall of a past life. And he saw his personality in the past life. And he realized that in his past life, he had been exactly the same kind of person. He had worked really, really hard, built up some kind of business for himself. And when he passed away, he was very proud of this. Yeah, I've done all of this by my own two hands, by my own hard work, by, you know, all of this. And he felt really good about himself, having built something up. But then he realized in this life, yeah, he realized actually, it's got nothing to do with me. The fact that I'm working hard in this life and been building up a business is not because I want to do this. It's because I'm just carrying on these personal traits from the past life. I'm just being like a robot. The past life, I was exactly a person like that. Now I'm just kind of following the same program, following the same habits, and doing exactly the same thing. And that's why I'm successful. It's not because I want to be successful. It's not because I have worked really hard and decided I want to do it this way. No, I'm just running on a program written sometime, who knows, long, long, long time in the past. And he said it had a very powerful effect on him. Yeah, when you see that, it's almost like you feel slightly repelled by it all. Because you understand that actually, instead of being your choice, something that you want to do, instead of being that, you are being run, you are being driven by this larger thing, this program going back in the past. And it feels repelled. Why? Because nobody really likes to be a robot. But that is essentially what he was saying. That is basically what we are. We are much more robotic than what we think we are. We are running on our old habits, running on all the same stuff we've done in the past, and we're doing that again in this life. Why are you doing what you're doing in this life? Sometimes people ask me, why am I a Buddhist monk? Yeah. And I always wish I could say, yeah, because I discovered Buddhism is so fantastic. It is the kind of meaning of life. This is what it's all about. That's why I became a Buddhist monk. But actually, that's just a fantasy. I don't think that's actually true. I think the reason why I become a Buddhist monk, yes, I do think that Buddhism is the answer to the meaning of life. I do think all of those things, but that's not actually the reason why I become a Buddhist monk. The reason why I become a Buddhist monk, I think, is because I think it's very likely that I was a Buddhist monk in a past life. Yeah, I am just also running on the program. I'm like a robot. Yeah, when I see Buddhism, I come again. Yes, sir. Do you want to ordain? Yes, please ordain me. Bang. Yeah. And it's almost embarrassing to have to admit that, but that, I think, is the reason. It feels to me like I made all these kind of, yes, wise decisions, yeah? Everybody wants to feel wise, yeah? Oh, I made this wise decision to become a monk. Actually, I don't think it is that simple. Then, of course, you start reading the suttas, you start getting more into Buddhism, and you start to realize that, well, actually, you know, I really am on the right track. This is a wonderful thing that I've been doing. But still, there is a lot, the majority of it, maybe everything of it, actually is just this kind of living out of ancient habits that have been there for so long. And the more you see of this, the more you see that, you know, you are just following these ancient patterns, the more worrying it kind of gets. Yeah, where are we heading? What is going on? The more kind of unsatisfactory this whole samsaric existence starts to become, because you feel more and more trapped. You feel more and more that actually, you know, whether you're going to get out of this or not is very uncertain after a while. So this kind of pushes you to kind of make a bit of extra effort, because you understand that the trap here is so profound and so dangerous in many ways. If you are prone in this life to getting angry easily, if you're prone to delusion, you're prone to certain defilements, yeah, now is the chance to do something with that. If you don't deal with those defilements in this life and now, you're going to carry them with you into the future. And eventually, it will have tremendously bad consequences for you. Because then you will not have the right teacher or the right teaching to kind of guide you in the right way. You get the wrong teaching, and those wrong teachings will perhaps encourage your defilements. You will start to act on them, and suddenly you're on the downward path very rapidly as a consequence. Now is the chance. Now is the opportunity to deal with these things. Don't allow your old habits to carry on into the future, because eventually they will let you down in a really bad way. So this is just some of the ways of thinking about this. Now, this is really kind of the Buddhist attitude towards this. And it may seem very stark. And because it seems so stark, it's important to remember also, as I said before, the opposite side of the Buddhist path. Yeah, the side which is the joy, the side which is the happiness, the side which is all of these positive things. But when you combine those two things together with the kind of the motivation to get out of the problem with the carrot of all these positive things, it becomes a very all-encompassing and very, I think, very good picture to carry us forward and kind of get us out of this predicament that we are, that we're all in. Okay, then the Buddha says at the very last sentence here, he says, it is enough to experience revulsion or repulsion towards all formations, all sankharas, enough to become dispassionate towards them, enough to be liberated from them. Revulsion towards all sankharas. Sankharas means all conditioned phenomena in the world, because that is what samsara is. It's just a collection of all the conditioned phenomena that exists. You feel repelled by it, because the whole thing just seems very unpleasant. The way that works, it's a bit like what you are seeing is suffering. And you can never really be attracted by suffering. Suffering is always going to seem repelling to some extent. You're going to be repelled by it. Don't want to have anything to do with it. So you're pushed away. And this is like the force that kind of drives you out of samsaric existence. Because this is very repelling, repulsive, unpleasant. And this is what this is about. And because you are repelled by it, you become dispassionate. You're dispassionate. The craving dies down. The craving disappears. You cannot crave for that which is suffering. And when the craving is gone, that is when you are liberated from all of this stuff. You are liberated because craving is the glue, craving is the tie, craving is the fetter that ties you to samsaric existence. When craving is gone, liberation is there. And that is what it means to become an arahant, fully awakened person, made an end to all of these problems, and you are finished with this. So, there you are. That is just some aspects of right view for you. And as I mentioned before, you can read the suttas if you like, and all the suttas are in a way about right view. It's about getting straightened out what the path is, how to practice, and all of these things come together. So as you keep reading the suttas, your view is going to get straightened out more and more. And remember, this is important. The things that I've been talking about now are important because the Noble Eightfold Path is a causal path where all the links are causally connected. And because they are causally connected, the very first factor is just so important. So if you can strengthen the first factor, make that into a power in your life that motivates you, drives you forward, it will be a very worthwhile investment. And this is why I have spent quite a lot of time on right view. There's one of you who wrote to me before the retreat saying, what are you going to talk about? What suttas are we, are you going to do? And then I said, I was thinking about doing the Noble Eightfold Path. And then you said that, well, if you're going to do the Noble Eightfold Path, spend a lot of time on right view. And that's what you said. And I think that's actually a very good point, because right view is very, very, very much a very important part of this. It stands at the foundation. But once we have achieved right view, then of course the practice really begins. And this is what I'm going to be looking at for the rest of this retreat, more practical things, how to develop this path in a positive way based on this right view. And this is what is going to be coming up next. I may, just for your information, I'm not really sure how this is going to work out. I may skip the next sutta, the soil remover. I may skip it because it isn't really required. And it is a very beautiful sutta, and it has the kind of the gradual training kind of mapped out very beautifully. But I think I have probably added a little bit too many suttas in here, so I may just remove that one so we can get on to the more details about the Noble Eightfold Path instead, just to make it clear what I intend to do next. Okay, so that is all for now, so we'll see you back again at 3 o'clock. Here.